a Friday, and that means it's time for a look back at what's transpired over the week with our guests from two political perspectives. Louis Wordes is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee and a former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Louis, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate.
And Rick Essenberg is with us. He's president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
The state's contract with Foxconn is expected to be signed this afternoon. Governor Scott Walker and Foxconn Chairman Terry Goh will sign the deal during a ceremony in Racine. And the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation voted Wednesday to approve the deal, which would provide nearly $3 billion in incentives to Foxconn if it invests $10 billion in a flat-screen factory in Mount Pleasant and employs 13,000 people. Tax credits would be tied to annual job creation numbers, and the deal calls for the company to pay back the credits if it falls short. Louis, let's start with you. Will this deal transform Wisconsin's economy?
Well, when I first heard about this, I thought, well, this is very good. And there is some potential that it puts us on the map to some extent as, a technology producing state. And then as I got to learn more about it and read more about it, there's a lot of problems here. The biggest problem, initially, when I heard about the amount of money, I thought, oh, my God. But it was a tax credit, and you don't get a tax credit unless they're paying taxes, so you're really forgiving taxes. Then I find out it's a refundable tax credit, which means basically you're basically paying out cash. And then as you look at it a little bit more, you realize this isn't a company that actually has products to make. This is a company that makes products for other companies. So they have to continually be bidding for contracts. And if they lose contracts, you lose a big chunk of work. It isn't like a company that can control its own production. Then they want to waive all the environmental laws, or a number of the environmental laws, and this company has a questionable record in that area. And here we're beginning to compromise what one of the things that makes Wisconsin so great is our environment, clean environment. So you begin to look at this, and you begin to see there's a lot of problems. And then the other thing that is really unfortunate is that when we were negotiating, when Wisconsin was negotiating, we weren't in much of a strong bargaining position because this goes back to the 250,000 jobs that Governor Walker promised 7 years ago that would be produced at a minimum in the first 4 years. He hasn't come close to that, and so he's in a position where he's trying to get something.
Well, let's let Rick weigh in here. The fiscal analysis on this is that taxpayers won't recoup the investment until 2042. Is it worth the hefty tax breaks, Rick?
Well, so in principle, this is the kind of thing that I don't like. I don't like the government intervening in the market and taking winners and losers. This isn't the first time that we've done this. I mean, we do this every day in Wisconsin through tax incremental financing, but this is one big, huge deal. So my initial reaction is not to like it. So I'm going to go the other way as Louis. My initial reaction was not to like it. But on the other hand, I understand that when you compete for a project like this, you can't unilaterally disarm yourself. So as much as I might like to think that there should be a national rule that no state can do this, the fact of the matter is that they can. And so I think Walker had to offer incentives. The incentives he offered, as it turned out, were much less than the incentives that were offered by Michigan. But the fact of the matter is this is giving public money to a private entity in the hope that the net advantage will be worth what paid out. And it's hard for us to know. People who are more knowledgeable about this than I am think that Foxconn can be transformational for the state of Wisconsin. But you don't just look at what Foxconn does. You look at the extent to which the presence of Foxconn transforms Wisconsin into a place that has expertise and is a destination for this type of manufacturing. All the environmental laws aren't waived. Federal environmental laws still apply. We just said we won't apply more stringent environmental requirements than the feds will. And with respect to this being a company that makes things that other people use in building the stuff that they build, that's really what Milwaukee was built on. A lot of the great companies in Milwaukee going back 150 years, they didn't make things that consumers bought. They made things that other people used in order to build things for consumers.
So where do you see us looking next, Rick, then, with Foxconn? Is it the legal aspect of it? Is it the where things start being built? What happens next in this process?
Well, I mean, I think people are going to scrutinize the contract a little bit more closely. I think that I suspect that there will be some legal challenges to Foxconn. I think for the most part, they will be unsuccessful. And ironically, that's because the sort of progressive left has generally made it impossible to challenge any type of use of public funds, even if it's given to a private entity. There may be a few things in the package, as I understand it, that will raise legal questions, but they're peripheral, and I don't think that they'll stop it. So I think it's going forward.
Senate Republicans released their own version of a tax plan yesterday, and it varies just enough from the House's bill to set the two chambers up for a pretty dramatic showdown over tax policy in coming weeks. Ned would like to address this. Hi, Ned. Go ahead.
Hi. The Republican tax reform bills, both in the House and Senate, give twice as much of a tax cut to corporations as they do to individuals, $1 trillion versus half a trillion dollars over 10 years. And the corporate tax cuts would be permanent. I don't think most people realize that, while individual tax cuts would be temporary and phased out. And the House bill is even worse than the Senate bill, because it keeps high-tax states like Wisconsin with high personal income taxes from allowing us to deduct our state and local taxes, whereas the Senate bill doesn't. But even the Senate bill gives a huge tax cut to corporations, and it might be phased in 1 year later, but even that is unacceptable because it's permanent and not temporary. So we need to contact our members of the House that are going to vote next week on this bill and tell them this isn't a good bill for people in Wisconsin.
Lewis, do you see this bill going through many iterations in the coming weeks?
I think this bill is going to be a very tough sell because, as the caller mentioned, I mean, this is not a fair bill at all. And the individual tax cuts, a huge chunk of those of that money is going to the very wealthy. You're talking about eliminating the alternative minimum tax. You're talking about eliminating the inheritance tax. I mean, these are taxes that that basically hit the wealthiest of people. And so what you're doing is really making the already unfortunate distribution of wealth in this country even worse. So I think this bill is going to have trouble. I think the House bill, I think this is kind of Ryan's dream bill, is, again, cutting into the programs that help regular people. Ryan has this fixation on basically taking care of the wealthy, and his repeal and replacement of Obamacare was an absolute disaster, and it went nowhere. And this bill, I would say, it will go nowhere except for the fact that Republicans are desperate to pass something. They have not passed one significant piece of legislation this whole year, so they feel obligated to do something. So we'll see. But I think it's a terrible bill, and we'll see what happens.
Rick, this is Speaker of the House Paul Ryan's bread and butter. Will he see it through?
So the notion that the tax cut is weighted towards corporate tax is not really a bug. It's a feature. And the idea is, and I think there's a lot to be said for the notion, that you ought to tax income when it's paid to shareholders or paid to employees. Corporations, you know, in other contexts, folks on the left are really quick to remind us that corporations are not people. They're not people. They're associations of people. And we have a very, very high corporate tax rate relative to the rest of the world. Now, a lot of companies are able to reduce that rate through various deductions. This simplifies the corporate tax rate, brings it down to roughly where it should be to make us globally competitive. As to the individual rates, it is almost impossible in the United States to have any type of broad-based tax cut where somebody will not be able to say that it favors wealthy taxpayers more than middle-income taxpayers, because the fact of the matter is that we have a highly progressive tax system in the United States of America, and that wealthy people pay most of the tax. This tax, this particular system proposal, I think is less weighted in that direction than others, and it's simply not true that the individual income taxes cuts are phased out. They are indexed in a different way than they are currently indexed, which arguably overstates inflation, and I think that's what the caller is talking about. I think that there are some issues here with the pass-through provisions that need to be looked more carefully, but if I can reassure the callers, I'm not wealthy, but I am, upper middle class, and my taxes are going up under this plan.
Ned, thanks for the call, and we'll just watch and wait and see how it moves on. But we need to move on right now. President Trump has a few days left to go on his tour of East Asia. He's in Vietnam today, wrapping up his trip in the Philippines. He spent a couple of days in China, where he met with President Xi Jinping to address differences over trade. The president said he didn't blame China for taking advantage of the U.S., but vowed to make trade deals more fair for America.
I do blame past administrations for allowing this out-of-control trade deficit to take place and to grow. We have to fix this, because it just doesn't work for our great American companies, and it doesn't work for our great American workers.
Lewis, did the president make any headway on the trade imbalance on this trip?
The China is a difficult country, and it's there's a lot of corruption. There is a lot of cheating. There is a lot of stealing of things. So it's it is in a very, very aggressive country. So I think Trump went there with the idea that he was going to straighten things out. What happened is he got finessed, because people are beginning to, around the world, are beginning to realize that what you have to do is really, wine them, dine them, give them, kind of a super special event, and events when he's visiting, and he kind of melts. And at the end of the day, he was basically gushing over Xi a lot more than Xi Jinping was gushing over him. And he's talking about $250 billion worth of contracts and all. A lot of those are already done deals. So, no, and even his Secretary of State made the comment that in the grand scheme, this is, trivial, this what Trump is talking about and what he's accomplished. So, he could have really done a lot more if he would have gone after things like, stealing our corporate secrets and things of that sort, the corporate espionage, which would be a lot more important than some of the things that he was spending his time dealing with.
Yeah, Rick, he was gushing there in China and certainly paying much respect and people paying respect to him. But as soon as he left China, he's returned to his tough campaign talk on trade, demanding a fair and equal basis. What did he accomplish in China?
Well, I'm not the biggest fan of Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is a developer. Developers blow hot and cold. They switch from bad cop to good cop very, very quickly. Mm. And I think to some extent he couldn't win here because if he would have gone in and he would have, confronted the Chinese in their own backyard, people would have said, well, that's undiplomatic. My concern is this. I don't think that Donald Trump understands international trade. A trade deficit is not taking advantage of the country that you run a trade deficit with. And I do think that he should be less worried about that. And here's where I'm going to agree with Lewis, more worried about issues that involve computer hacking and violation of intellectual property rights. Because I think to the extent that the Chinese can be criticized for something, it's that, as opposed to selling goods inexpensively that Americans want to buy.
North Korea has also loomed large on this Asia tour. In South Korea Tuesday, he said the U.S. military is ready to go, but hope to God that it doesn't come to that. In Pyongyang, he urged to work with the global community. Let's take a listen.
I really believe that it makes sense for North Korea to come to the table and to make a deal that's good for the people of North Korea and the people of the world.
So there he is giving his speech. He's about 120 miles away from Pyongyang. Lewis, were you holding your breath that there wouldn't be any missteps here in his rhetoric?
The problem that you have with this, Donald Trump, is there is no intellectual core to him. He has no real positions outside of, you know, making money. He's just fixated on, you know, everything's a deal, and a deal to him is money. It's just making money. There's more important things, and I was basically watching, but I think the person who was sitting on pins and needles was Moon Jae-in, who is the president of South Korea, and who is trying to, you know, develop a little bit more of a relationship with North Korea, and he had, you know, in his earlier life was much more political and political to the left, and he was there are some sympathies where he's thinking, okay, maybe we can open some doors. And he was the one that was frightened to death that Trump would stumble into something that could begin to start a war. But Trump's people scripted him well, and he seemed, you know, when he's in these foreign countries, I think he realizes he's so over his head that he kind of stays closer to the script. And that's, as you mentioned, when he gets back, you know, out of the country, he starts going back to his, you know, kind of foolish rhetoric. But when he's in the countries, he seems to be holding to the scripts they're giving him, and that's good.
Rick Essenberg, before we transition here, what about the president's approach right now to North Korea? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, North Korea is an extremely intractable problem, and it always has been. It's very easy to blame, you know, Obama and Clinton and the Bush, both Bush presidents, for the situation that we're in, and certainly they did fail to stop it. On the other hand, part of the reason they failed to stop it is that there was not a great option for doing so now. Right now it's a very intractable situation because you have this kind of very bizarre and repressive regime, and but, you know, they've got nuclear weapons now, and while the nuclear weapons may not be a huge threat to the United States, they are quite a threat to Seoul, and so it's hard to criticize any American president at this point because the options are not good.
We're breaking down the week's news, hearing two perspectives on this week in review with Lewis Fortas. He's editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Rick Essenberg is with us as well, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. You can join in as well, 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Democrats' victory? Is a sound rejection of President Trump and his policies, or were the wins this week overstated? What about the conversation of guns in America following the Texas mass shooting? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment. Mm-hmm. Week in Review, it is on. It's a Friday. Time for a roundtable look at the week's developments with Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And Louis Fortas is here, Editor-in-Chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee and a former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. You can add your insights, 800-642-1234. Where do you see the conversation around guns going after another mass shooting now in Texas in Sutherland Springs? Were the Democratic governorship victories a sound rejection of President Trump and his policies, or were they wins? What kind of wins were they this week in elections? Were they overblown? What bill caught your attention this week in the state legislature? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The pastor at the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs says the church will be demolished after 26 people were shot to death by Devin Kelly on Sunday. Authorities say he fired at least 450 rounds at worshipers before he was shot by a local resident. Kelly later took his own life. President Trump in Tokyo, meanwhile, described the shooting as a mental health problem at the highest level. Louis, what was your reaction to this latest mass shooting and the political fallout from it?
I mean, it's always so sad and so tragic when these events happen because, you know, everybody involved, the victims are all very innocent people. They're you and me who are just going on with our lives, and all of a sudden, you know, whether we're walking down the street and you're getting run over by a truck or whether you're in a church and you're getting killed or whatever. So the Democrats come back and bring up the fact that guns are out of control in this country relative to every other developed country in the world. And the Republicans don't want to touch the gun issue because they're afraid of the NRA, and they blame it on mental health. And Trump is saying it's a big mental health issue. And I think the situation is this. There are serious, and you know, people have mental health issues. Mental health is like any other health issue. I mean, we have it in this country. We have mental health issues. People have mental health issues around the world. We don't take that. We view mental health issues very differently than we view physical health. If somebody has cancer, it's one thing, but if they have mental health issues, they view it differently. That's wrong, and we need to deal with mental health issues. But having said that, then the question is, if you have mental health issues throughout the world, why are we the ones that have all these mass murders and other developed countries, you know, don't, or very few? And so then you get back to the fact that we have we need some sound and reasonable gun protection legislation. It's a little combination of both.
Yeah, okay. But, and Rick, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted, "Thoughts and prayers are not enough, GOP. We must end this violence. We must stop these tragedies. People are dying while you wait." What about gun legislation? Did it get any traction? Are we going anywhere? Rick Essenberg.
Well, I mean, I remember having this conversation actually on this show after one of these incidents happened, and you know that was only maybe a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that
Las Vegas.
Underscores, I think, the tragedy of this. But the problem is that when something like this happens, everybody sort of runs and they embrace a symbolic position. I'm either pro-gun or I want more gun control. And the conversation really has to be more granular and specific than that. What particular things do you want to do, and what is the likelihood that they will have that they will prevent something like this? I think that there are a number of things that you probably could do, but if you look at these particular proposals, they tend to have a great deal of popular support. Unfortunately, when you ask people whether they think that they'll do much to solve the problem, they say that they don't think it will. And part of the problem is that it won't. We talk about, for example, having universal background checks. It's often called the gun show exception. That's not what it is. It's actually the situation is that when there's a private sale of guns, There's no background check. Well, maybe we should have that. But the problem here is that it was illegal for this guy to possess any gun at all. And he bought it, and there was a background check, but the Air Force didn't report what he had done. And so he was able to buy the gun. And this is a reminder that, you know, we can pass laws, but laws are not magic bullets, and they don't necessarily have the impact that we want. But sure, I think that there are some things that we could look at, and I think there's some things that we could do, and I think that we should discuss the particular issues rather than, you know, making this be something that we have to divide ourselves into camps over.
Let's bring in Artis now in Delafield. Hi, Artis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I believe this is both, I mean, I do believe it's largely a gun issue and access to guns, but, you know, the Republicans are taking the stand that it's a mental health issue. Well, if they're going to do that, then why are they, you know, is the first thing on the chopping block mental health benefits? I mean, I don't think they really have a leg to stand on with that.
And, Lewis, are we seeing the dollars in, I mean, this is also tied to the whole healthcare debate here, and funding for mental health is wrapped up in where healthcare heads next.
There's never been parity between mental health issues or mental health problems and physical health problems. The caller, I agree with the caller that, we need to, certainly the gun issue, I think there are some obvious things that we can do in terms of protecting us. And one of them is the gun show loophole, which is really the private sales, as Rick pointed out. But no, mental health issues are always on the back burner. They seem to get cut before other things do. And I think at some point we have to do what some of the other advanced countries have done, and that is take mental health issues seriously.
Artis, thank you so much for calling in. Let's move on here. Tuesday was Election Day. Good night for Democrats, especially in Virginia. Ralph Northam defeated Republican Ed Gillespie in the race for governor. Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez said voters are rejecting President Trump.
America needs healers. Healers like Ralph Northam. We don't need dividers like Donald Trump. You have sent a message tonight, not simply to the voters in the Commonwealth of Virginia. You have sent a message across the globe to South Korea. Donald Trump, you don't stand for our values.
So DNC clearly ramped up by the wins. Democrats also had wins for the New Jersey governor, mayor in several cities as well went to Democrats, New York, Boston, Detroit. Rick, your insights on Election Day.
Well, I think we have to be careful not to make too much of it. These were largely blue states acting like blue states. And it's not surprising that the Democrats would sweep in New Jersey, particularly given that Chris Christie has a 14% approval rate because of Bridgegate. Not surprising that he would sweep in Virginia. Trump, to the extent that you believe this, says that he's going to clean out the swamp that is Washington, D.C., and that's where the denizens of the swamp live. But Virginia has also become a blue state, I think largely because of its proximity to Washington, D.C., and it's not surprising to see the Democrats do well there. But I think my Republican friends would be remiss if they simply dismissed this, because I think you can see some evidence here that even though Trump has pursued, for the most part, the more or less conventional conservative agenda that I think his sort of more mainstream Republican voters wanted him to pursue, he's turning them off with the way that he behaves, with tweeting, with sort of creating this sense of insecurity and uncertainty about what he's going to do next. This is something that, you know, arguably he could fix before the midterm elections. He doesn't seem to be inclined to do that. He doubled down, sort of trying to throw Ed Gillespie, who I think had sort of he was not a Trumpist type of candidate, but I think moved in that direction during the election. I think that Republicans have something to learn from this. I think that they need to take what happened seriously, and if they don't do that, there may be a bigger wave in the midterm elections than it needs to be.
Let's bring in Nate now, who is in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, thank you. I was going to point out that Virginia, like Wisconsin, has a very gerrymandered state legislature, so its elections at that level of state government were basically rigged. And the candidate who won the governor's race in Virginia said that he supported nonpartisan redistricting. And so now they're actually going to have it. And if you look at the vote totals for Virginia, the only reason that the state legislature didn't flip and flip by a noticeable margin, because right now it's kind of close, was that the elections were so rigged that even though the vote was like 53% for one party and 44 for the other, where it was obvious, the election, or rather the elections were rigged just by gerrymandering. So they're going to do away with that, and I think that we should in Wisconsin. The only reason we haven't already is because you've got people who don't want to loosen up their power, and you know, and there are those who are fighting to keep it that way, and fortunately including, I think, the Wisconsin Institute to outlaw liberty in that.
Well, let's get Lewis to reflect on that and takeaways from Tuesday voters. What do you think, Lewis?
Okay, first of all, in response to your caller, the gerrymander issue has gotten out of control, and I think Wisconsin is the poster child for this idea of it being highly partisan and out of control. And as a result, as people know, there's a case that the Supreme Court has already had their hearing on, and we're waiting for a decision by the Supreme Court as to whether Wisconsin's, well, first of all, there was a panel of three judges that basically said that our legislature is illegal, and so we'll see if the Supreme Court confirms that. So that is a very, very serious problem, and we have to figure out ways to deal with a fairer way to redistrict. But the story that would have been a real story would have been had the Republicans won either of the governor's race. And I think Rick is right. They're both of these states are lean Democratic. Chris Christie was an unusual guy. He was a great retail campaigner, and as a result, he could win over moderates and even Democrats. But you had the real story was the Democrats were very, very nervous about Virginia, because Northam, is someone who no one can accuse of being charismatic, and it was looking like this might be a real close race. And Gillespie, who has been the head of the Republican National Committee and been in politics a long time, and was running kind of a tricky race. He was running one race for the northern part of Virginia and a separate race for the southern part of Virginia. But anyway, not only did Northam win, but he won by a huge majority. And also they picked up the Democrats picked up a lot of seats in their legislature, and so it turned out to be a very strong night for Democrats in Virginia, and New Jersey, of course, because that is a much more of a Democratic state. So the question is, was it going forward, going into the 2018 elections? I think the Republicans are in some trouble. And as you can see, a lot of Republican Congress people are bailing out, and you know, they can see the kind of the handwriting on the wall, and you can see these
waves.
Well,
let's let Rick, are Republicans in trouble heading into 2018? And we're about to go into Governor Scott Walker's bid in just a moment.
Well, look, Trump's approval rating is extremely low, right? Historically low for a first-term president. I think he has it within his power to remedy that, because I think the reason that it is low is not because of what the Trump administration has done from a policy perspective. One of the things that I was worried about is whether, Trump was going to sort of move or govern in a way which was substantially to the left of the Republican mainstream. I think that his campaign rhetoric pointed in that direction. He hasn't really done that. But he's caused a certain amount of cognitive dissonance, and I think that by his behavior. And I think Gillespie tried to a little bit to thread the needle by trying to distance himself from Trump personally, but yet appear to be embracing Trumpism by, particularly talking a lot about immigration and crime, which is more of a Trump issue. And it didn't work. And I think Republicans need to acknowledge the fact that it didn't work and not make the mistake that both political parties keep making when sort of the more robust members of their base think that, well, what we have to do is just do the same thing that we did when we lost, except do it harder. Mm. That's not the answer here. And so I think Republicans have some real soul searching to do.
Well, meanwhile, Governor Scott Walker kicked off his bid for a third term Sunday at a manufacturing facility in Waukesha.
I'm pleased. I am thrilled on behalf of our outstanding Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish and I to announce today that Rebecca and I are asking for four more years to serve as your governor and Lieutenant Governor to move Wisconsin forward.
And he went on to say he's not done cutting taxes, making college more affordable, fighting opioid abuse, putting people to work. More than a dozen Democrats are at least thinking of running against Governor Walker for next year's election. Lewis, where do we stand after this week?
Well, the interesting thing is that Scott Walker is running for re-election because after he made his effort to run for president, and Donald Trump essentially humiliated him, and he didn't even make it to the Iowa caucuses. He came back, and I think he was looking for a job and throwing out feelers to national institutions or Fox News and things of that sort, and nobody was interested. And so now he comes back and saying, okay, I'll run again for governor. And he's trying to make himself the underdog. If you listen to some of his stuff, he's saying, we have to, the Democrats are going to have all these resources against me. This guy's going to have unlimited money. I mean, he has a Rolodex or whatever they have nowadays in terms of a list of donors that he will do very, very well financially. And so he's trying to make himself the underdog. And I think people are getting tired of him. I think after his failed attempt at the presidency, he was at about 40% in the polls. He's built it back up a bit. And there's a reason there's a half dozen Democrats have declared and another half dozen are looking at running.
And I have to step in here. Yeah, Rick, we're way past our break. And just a quick feel from you. Third terms, they're a heavy lift. Is this doable for Walker?
Well, there's a heavy lift, but we tend to like incumbents in Wisconsin. So I think it's more than doable. And while there are six Democrats that are running against Scott Walker, they are not an impressive group politically. I don't need to comment on them personally. But none of them seems like much of a threat at this point.
It is the Week in Review. Rick Essenberg is with us, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Lewis Ford is here as well, former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly, Editor-in-Chief of Shepherd Express. You as well, 800-642-1234. Looking at what went down in the Wisconsin legislature this week, what bills were you following? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. We Week in Review, it's in full swing here on the Ideas Network with Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Rick Essenberg here as well, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. You can join in as well. What news items did you follow closely this week? How do you feel about what transpired? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents approved a plan to merge the system's two-year schools with its four-year campuses. That went down yesterday. That means the 13 two-year schools will become regional branches of the 13 four-year schools. So what do you see, Rick, with this move from the UW System Board of Regents?
Well, I hope it's the beginning of I think the University of Wisconsin system could use some efficiencies generally. We have a lot of four-year campuses in a lot of places, and I think closing a four-year campus might be politically impossible. I suspect it is, but I think a strong efficiency case could be made that it ought to be done. Now, this, as I understand it, isn't much of a move at all, in the sense that it isn't really closing anything. It's consolidating control within the four-year campuses, I suppose with the hope that this will reduce administrative costs. And I think if that turns out to be the case, it's a good idea.
All right. Well, Louis, is this an efficiency move for the UW? Will it work? And what do we know? What was disclosed this week about the cost savings?
If Rick is correct, I agree with him that if there's some efficiencies that can be made at the and cost saving at the administrative level, that would be great. The big concern is this: you need a lot of these branch campuses out in the smaller communities, because these are the communities that have fewer people with a college education. These are the communities where, you know, the kids going to college are going to be first generation kids, as I was going to college. And, you know, it's daunting to end up at a big four-year school. So these two-year campuses are a good way to get started in college, especially again for first-generation college kids. And I think for that reason, they're very, very critical. So if they can pull this off by, you know, some consolidation at the top level, but keep these branches open, call them whatever you want, but keep them open and get these first-generation kids a first step into college.
Well, we have a small handful of bills that we want to zip through here pretty quickly, so we'll have to keep comments brief. The Senate passed a bill Tuesday that would lift the moratorium on sulfide mining in Wisconsin. The Assembly passed it last week. Governor Walker said he'll sign it, even though he supported the moratorium as a member of the State Assembly back in 1998. So, Rick, what do you think about this passage?
I think it's a good idea. I think the moratorium had turned into an unintended ban. I think that there are plenty of strong regulations left. I think that particularly in these rural parts of the state who have been so devastated economically, this is good news.
Louis, was this unneeded legislation finally being undone?
I think Rick is totally wrong on this one, and this is terrible legislation. First of all, they couch this in job creation. Technology has changed, and even if they did build another mine, the amount of jobs are going to be few, relatively speaking, and the possibility of polluting the waterways, the groundwater, and hurting tourism, which does create a ton of jobs in Wisconsin, it's just a really poor piece of legislation, and it's basically driven by some mining companies that are writing a few small checks, relatively speaking, to some of these legislators, and they're acting like they're little puppy dogs for the big mining companies. It's terrible.
Next up, the Senate voted to eliminate the state's minimum hunting age. Right now, you have to be at least 12 to buy a hunting license or hunt with a gun, unless you're participating in a mentored hunt. In that case, you can be as young as 10. So under this bill, anybody of any age can participate in a mentored hunt. Rick, what do you think of the passage?
Not a hunter, so I'm probably not the best one to comment on this. I note that apparently 34, 35 states have no minimum hunting age. I'm not aware that that's caused catastrophes there, so I can't get really excited about it, but I'm not a hunter, so not in the best position to comment.
All right, Lewis, pass to you. What do you think?
I think a kid can wait till they're 12 years old to be out hunting. It just seems, unnecessary.
And Governor Walker is expected to sign a bill that would limit election results. The Assembly passed it in June. The Senate passed it on Tuesday. Only candidates who trail the winner by a percentage point or less in statewide elections can ask for a recount. The move is in response to Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's request. Even though she finished a distant fourth in Wisconsin last year, Democrats say that if a candidate wants to foot the bill, there should be no problem. Rick?
Well, I mean, I think that what happened with Jill Stein and Hillary Clinton was kind of a charade. Recounts should be undertaken because there's some possibility of the election being flipped. If the person who has an opportunity to win the election, if the recount is successful, doesn't want to do it, then there ought not to be a recount. I also think that the bill recognizes technology has changed and our counts are pretty accurate. And a lot of times under current law, you have the right to request a recount, and there's absolutely no possibility that the election is going to be flipped. So I think restricting this to the person who is likely to benefit from it is a good idea.
And Lewis.
And Rick, what are you afraid of transparency for? Why not do a recount? Jill Stein spent between $3 and $4 million, which was outside money coming into our state, going into people's pockets who did the work on the recount. What's wrong with that? And if there's no problem with them, let them recount it, let them come up with the same number, and let's take the $3 to $4 million and spend it in Wisconsin.
And very, very quickly, Susan in Westfield is going to open up the drinking age. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, yesterday the Assembly passed the Senate version of a social host bill that made it illegal for adults to provide a location for underage persons to be having drinking parties. And we know it's illegal to drink, of course, in Wisconsin, but to serve alcohol to young people to drink in Wisconsin. But the fact that this loophole was in the law that you can still provide a location and kids can bring their own stuff, and if you can look the other way, whatever. So that is now illegal, and I think that's a fabulous thing.
And Rick, very quickly, up or down?
Up, I agree.
And Lewis, your turn.
This is, they passed a bill also on the drinking age, dropping it to 19 if it doesn't affect the transportation money that we're getting. And again, this should be a state issue, and if this is what they want, then, fine.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you, Susan, for coming in there in the final seconds. Lewis Fordes is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Assembly. Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. This hour was produced by Bill Martins with technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend and hope to meet you back here Monday.